Well, it's time for On Your Money. Each week at this time, we have Kevin McKinley, our financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, come on and give you the benefit of his wisdom to help you improve your financial situation. Kevin, good to talk to you again.
Hello, John.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of us have significant stress about finances. The research shows that about three-quarters of us have stressed out about money at least once in the last month or so. If money issues are stressing you out, I guess, you know, we're in good company. You're not alone.
Well, that's right, and that's according to the American Psychological Association, and they ought to know, right?
Well, we would hope so.
They just released their annual Stress in America survey, and they took the psychological pulse of 3,000 American adults in August of 2014. And as you mentioned, 72% reported feeling stress about money just in the past month. 22% said they feel extreme stress about money. 26% said that they're stressed about money most or all of the time. And the stress was most significant among parents, especially those of younger children, young adults, and women. And a third of the people who were in relationships reported that money is a major source of relationship conflict. And I think it wasn't in the report, but two-thirds said it was the battle over the television remote control.
Yeah. Okay. Or the use of the iPad at the dinner table.
That's right.
How do these figures, and I don't mean to make light of this because money stress is, well, it's just about the worst kind. How do these figures compare to previous reports?
Well, there is some good news there. Overall, the improving economy is reducing money stress, at least among the respondents. There's a direct correlation between unemployment falling and incomes rising somewhat, helping to reduce this stress. But the reduction in stress is more so for those people on higher incomes, and there's a gap emerging that's very troubling between higher-income people and lower-income people. The lower-income people are still reporting higher levels of stress, and that has been mitigated somewhat, obviously, for those people who are in the higher-income brackets. And according to the APA, this stress is affecting people's health because not only is it bad for their health, but their financial straits and constraints prevent them from going to the doctor and getting treated for conditions that they otherwise would have looked at.
Well, what do you think are the financial causes of these stressors?
Some of them cited in the survey were the obvious culprits: unexpected expenses coming up, trying to pay for essentials, and then longer-term goals like saving for retirement. And that is reality. And many people are suffering just because they don't have enough income and enough money coming in to cover the basics for it. And while it is better, it's still not good, at least to the point of where it was, say, 10 years or so. But part of it comes from a lack of savings. Bankrate.com reported a survey where they said 60% of their adult respondents could not pay a $1,000 repair bill if it came in unexpectedly. The average retirement account balance per household in America is about $3,000 right now. The average credit card debt balance is about $15,600, according to creditcards.com, and about a third of households and credit card holders do carry a balance like that. And then, of course, we have the student loan balances, which are averaging about $30,000 right now. And this was very startling, and especially it shows why a lot of young adults are stressed out about money. In 12 states right now, over half of the 25-year-olds in that particular state live with their parents. And these are big states. These are New York, New Jersey, California, Florida, and Illinois. And not only is that probably stressing out the people having to live with their parents, but I'm guessing it's stressing out the parents as well.
Well, but that certainly isn't the whole story, though, is it?
No, and a lot of this is psychological and emotional. If you look around, and especially if you spend a lot of time on the web or on social media, it looks like everybody else is doing better than you are. They're having more fun. If you look on Facebook, it seems like everybody's going someplace or buying something interesting or doing something that's fun that a lot of people feel like they can't afford to do. And then in other cases, especially in young adults, I think there's some sense of feeling bad, of feeling like you're not doing as well as your parents might have done in a similar situation. And a couple things to think about that is to realize that almost everybody feels stress about money. Whether you have no money or millions of dollars, money can be a very stressful subject, as the results from this survey portrayed. And many, many people are worse off than you are, no matter how bad your situation is. And the parents may have even been worse off than you are right now. If you're in your 20s, talk with your parents and try to get the true story about where they're at. They didn't always live in this really nice home or have these great cars and have money to go out and travel. Many of them started out in tiny, cruddy apartments, didn't have a car, or had cars that barely ran. And they, at that point in their 20s, didn't know how they were going to make it either. And finally, times are very different. Job security and incomes and job availability for high-income jobs just aren't where they were 10 or 20 or even 30 years ago. And it's sad, quite frankly, for the middle class. It also means that we have to adjust our expectations and say, you know what, we're doing the best we can, and hopefully things will get better.
All right, Kevin, just a note to our listeners, the number to call to talk about your financial questions is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The email address is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org, 800-642-1234. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making investment decisions. Well, it's time for the mailbag on Your Money. Several listeners have asked you, Kevin, to recommend a few personal finance books to help them learn more about money and improve their situation. So what do you have for us?
Well, there are millions of books out there, and it should seem like just about any topic has been covered, but there's a problem trying to find the right one for you. First of all, several of them, if you're looking for an actual paper book, have been put together years ago, if not even months ago, and so some of the information is outdated. And then usually a common complaint with readers of personal finance books are that the information is too deep, it's way over their head, or it's just not what they're looking for, or it's not enough information, meaning they don't go deep enough. But there are a few, depending on your situation. And of course, if you are a truly frugal listener, you will not buy these books. You will go and check them out at your local library.
So, what about the basics of personal finance?
One of my favorites is Personal Finance for Dummies, and I don't mean any insult by the title, but Eric Tyson writes those, and there's a couple other ones for that Dummies series, and it has a lighter tone that makes it a little easier to grasp. It's not as dense as some of the other ones out there, but it does have something that'll get you started on every single different personal finance topic that most people are going to face. And then if you need more information out there, there are other books that dive deeper into things like insurance or investments, etc.
Okay, so how about something that provides some insight on becoming financially independent?
I read this at a very early age, and it had a very positive and strong effect on me, The Millionaire Next Door. And while some of it, the numbers might be a little outdated, the concepts are timeless. And what it says is basically that people who become financially independent do so by spending less than what they earn, and they typically don't look rich. They typically drive older cars, they live in smaller homes, and they don't wear a lot of flashy clothes. They're more likely to shop at secondhand shops, but they save more money, and more importantly, they spend as little as they possibly can.
Okay, for those who maybe need to dig themselves out of a financial hole, what do you recommend for them?
There is another guy who's on commercial radio named Dave Ramsey, and some of the things that he says I don't agree with, but he is very good at helping people who are in a financial hole dig themselves out. And that's Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover is the name of this book. And some of it is a little harder to swallow, but a lot of it is good basic information of how to stop using debt and try to get out of that from under that debt, stop spending money that you shouldn't, and stop, more importantly, borrowing money that that you shouldn't, and how to pay off those credit cards. And many of the people who have followed this program swear by it, and in many cases, he's saved their financial situations, their marriages, and their lives.
Okay, well, good recommendations there, Kevin. We have an email question for you. The question is, I'm 13 months removed from a Chapter 7 bankruptcy and working on rebuilding my credit. My current score is 608, up from 541 a year ago. I have just been approved by Capital One for my first ever unsecured credit card with a $300 limit and a 22.9% APR. What is my best way to use the card to increase my credit rating and score?
Well, that's a really great question, and congratulations on moving up from the Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And it is possible to do. It's difficult. It takes longer than we would want it to, but good for this listener here. And the credit score at 608 is not good, but it's certainly better than the 541. The way to use this is just to charge little small amounts that you know you can for sure pay off every single month on time. And several things will happen once you establish a brief pattern of doing that. And by brief, I usually mean just 6 months or so. When you put it together with responsible use, you might see the credit limit bumped up to $500 or $1,000. You might see the interest rate drop down from that high 23% into the mid-teens or low teens. And finally, you might see yourself getting new credit card offers because they say, hey, this is a person who uses credit cards and can actually handle the responsibility now and pay the bills off. So we're going to offer this person one as well. And the more that you charge something on it and then pay it off right away, the higher your credit score will go and the lower your interest costs will be.
All right. Thanks for that email question. You can send an email question to Kevin McKinley. Here's the address, On Your Money, all one word, onyourmoney@WPR.org. Or you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We're getting some calls. We're going to take a brief pause, and when we come back, we'll have more with Kevin McKinley on Your Money. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is with me. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is with me. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And Kevin, as you might expect, we have lots of phone calls. Let's go to one right now. We'll start in Madison, where Kathy is with us. Kathy, you're on with Kevin McKinley. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Good morning. Kevin, I am humbled to be sharing the airwaves with you.
Well, let's see how this call goes first before you do that. But thank you very much, Kathy.
Fair enough. My question relates to the state's 529 plans. When we first moved to Wisconsin about a decade ago, we set up 529 plans for our kids, and I needed to be checking something about them recently. Several years back, they switched from Wells Fargo to different management, and everything in our account switched over automatically, and I didn't think twice about it. When I went online to locate the website, I was very surprised to find that there are two things that both say that they're Wisconsin's 529 plan. One says it's Edvest, and the one that we're with says it's called Tomorrow's Scholar. And I'm wondering if you can tell me about the differences between those.
How did you end up in the Tomorrow's Scholar plan?
It happened to us. When we first came to the state, we started 529 plans with, as my understanding was, the only option that was in Wisconsin. Those were managed through Wells Fargo for some time, and then a few years back, Wells Fargo bailed out of that somehow, and our accounts were automatically moved into Tomorrow's Scholar.
Okay, you can. My preference, in without going into too much detail on it, is the actual Edvest one. And so you'll find that the you probably like the investment options within the actual Edvest plan a little better than the Tomorrow Scholar one. You can go to edvest.com, edvest.com. Have you been there yet, Kathy?
I came to you first.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, again, I'm flattered. Go to edvest.com, and that's a plan that will probably provide lower cost to you and maybe more investment options than the Tomorrow Scholar one. And if you're doing this yourself and you can, want to invest directly, that's usually the best way to go. But I'd contact Edvest and tell them your situation, tell them what you want to do, and they'll explain your different options with it. And it is possible in many cases to move money from one 529 plan to another. So if you decide you like one better than the one you're in, you can go ahead and do that. And as long as you do it under the rules of the plans and the 529s, there won't be any taxes on any earnings or anything like that when you move it from one to the other.
Kathy, thanks for calling in, and good luck with that. We had an email on a related question to what Kathy just asked about from Joan, and here's what she has to ask. The question I have has to do with Edvest account fund options. Could you explain the difference between the three types of accounts they offer, individual, custodial, and entity? What are the advantages of each type?
Well, the individual one is one where a person owns it for themselves. And the custodian one is where a person, usually a parent, owns it for on behalf of another one. And it really boils down to the Social Security number. And whose Social Security number are they using? And with the individual one, the individual controls the money because it's that person's Social Security number, and they can open up for the benefit of children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, whomever they want. With the custodial one, that money is technically the child's money. And when he or she ages into majority, which is a number usually between 18 and 21, depending on the state in question, the child gets to take over the money and do with it whatever he or she wants, and that includes not spending it on college. The entity one is when you have a trust or something that would own the account. So I definitely recommend if you want to maintain control of the money, and it is already your money, it's not the child in question's money, that you open up an individual account, not the custodial.
And what would be the advantage of an entity account?
Well, it's not so much an advantage. It's just a titling method of the way. If the money is already owned by something like a trust, that's the who would have to be the owner of the account.
Okay. We have more calls. Let's go to Mount Horeb, where Vicki is on the line. Vicki, thanks for joining us on Your Money.
Good morning, Kevin and John. My husband and I were just recently victims of the big Anthem security breach where millions of Social Security numbers were stolen. Mm-hmm. And we are debating about credit freeze versus fraud alert. Could you help us make that decision?
Sure. Have you gone to Anthem's website yet? I'm sorry, let me back up for Vicki. What this is, for people who don't know, people who were customers of Anthem Health Insurance, hackers got into the system and apparently got all of the client's information, about 80, I think it's 80 million or something like that. And that's reason for alarm, not panic. And what you're doing, Vicki, is the right thing. So have you been to anthem.com yet to follow their instructions?
Well, what they had said is that we're going to be receiving letters in the mail mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. instructions.
Okay.
That was my understanding. And, you know, I certainly will go. We did go on the website briefly right after it happened. I should probably do that again.
Mm-hmm.
But we just want to make sure that, you know, we're protecting ourselves as much as we can.
Right. The fraud alert is something that's a little softer prevention, and what it does is it's a little better at, if you feel like there won't be a problem, but you just want to know if something can come up on it. When you actually freeze the credit report, that's when you go to each one of the big three bureaus in this case and go and say to them, we do not want anyone to be able to open a credit card in our name, including us. Without us giving permission for it. And it costs money to do that. The fraud alert generally doesn't cost money to have done. And especially in many of these credit bureau cases, Vicki, if you've been the victim of identity theft, you can get the fees waived. But to freeze the credit report, it usually costs $10 to do it, and then it costs $10 to thaw it again. But the only reason you would need to thaw it generally is if somebody, some entity that you don't already have a relationship with, meaning you were opening up a new credit card or getting a new car loan, said, hey, before we can give you this loan, we need to check your credit report. And you would have to say, okay, which bureau are you going to use, because, and when are you going to check? Because I will thaw it for that period of time. I'll open up it for inquiries. And then after they say, okay, we have the information we need, then you would close it again. And for people who are interested in doing this, I highly suggest that you do it. It's one of the least expensive ways to prevent people from using your information to borrow money and then not pay it back. Go to tinyurl.com, tinyurl.com/... C-Freeze. Yep, TINYURL.com and then a / C-Freeze. The letter C and the word freeze. And I set that up as a direct link to all different states' credit freezing requirements and procedures, because these are technically governed by state laws and there are different procedures for each state. Or you can just contact each one of the bureaus directly and say, I'd like to freeze a report. I'm sure they're getting inundated with calls right now, especially in light of this problem with Anthem. And I'd recommend people, I'm glad you asked this, Vicki, because this is something that will continue. I mean, people, companies and organizations spend literally trillions of dollars a year trying to prevent against this. But anytime, if one person can get into the system, technically anybody can get into the system. And so it's very difficult to prevent against this. So I'd highly recommend that you explore this option now, even if you weren't an affected customer.
Now, one thing we have heard, and whether it's true or not, by what you said, I'm guessing it's not, because we do order things online. So if your credit report is frozen, it's not, and we order something online, will we have difficulty, like with our credit card that we've had for years and years and years?
Absolutely not. As long as you have available credit on that credit card, the freeze will not affect that. It's not that they freeze your credit. It's they freeze your credit information. And so people can't go to the bureau, or credit card issuers can't go to the bureau and get information about you. Right now, if anyone has your Social Security number, they can pretend to be you and try to get a credit card from any issuing credit card company. And once they use your information, and they'll run into a freeze, and the credit card company will say, well, we can't get that information to issue you a card because the report is frozen.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Vicki, thanks for the call. Good luck, yeah. Well, let's take another call. We've got Karen in Lake Geneva with us next. Karen, welcome to On Your Money.
Good morning. So my question is more around, I actually contribute about 10% of my annual income to our 401k plan. But I've noticed that there is an option for me to also, in addition to the 10%, distribute money towards either a pre-tax 401k or a pre-tax Roth or an after-tax Roth. And I'm just wondering if this is something I should be considering.
Are you looking at that right now, Karen, or are you going from memory?
I'm going from memory.
Okay, because the pre-tax Roth is kind of like it's an oxymoron. It's like jumbo shrimp. They really don't allow a pre-tax contribution to a Roth. Usually, all contributions that go into any kind of Roth account are after tax, meaning that you don't get a tax break when you make the contribution. But any earnings on the account stay sheltered while they are in the Roth, and then if you pull it out in retirement, subject to certain constraints, they're tax free. The question in this situation that you should be interested in knowing the answer to is, how much should I put into one versus the other, pre-tax or after-tax? And that is really dictated, in my mind anyway, by your tax bracket versus what it is now versus what it is in retirement. And most people who work are in a higher tax bracket while they're working than they will be when they are retiring. Therefore, it's better off to use pre-tax retirement savings vehicles to the maximum amount either within your budget or by set by law, rather than using after-tax plans at work. And if you say, well, I'd like to have some of that money sheltered but have it available in an after-tax scenario, meaning I can pull it out tax-free, then if you qualify, use a pre-tax contribution plan at work and then open up Roth IRAs for yourself. And probably 90% of taxpayers are eligible to open up Roth IRAs.
Karen, thanks for your question. Good luck. Let's take another quick call. We'll go to Milwaukee where Joe is with us. Joe, you're on with Kevin McKinley.
Good morning. My question is, our bank just offered us, we just got our mortgage loan last year and 30-year fixed, and they just offered us to switch to a 12-year fixed, and then our interest would go down from 4.125 to 2.99, and I'm just wondering if it's, you know, what do I need to look for, if it's too good to be true, everyone keeps telling me you should do it. Our payment would roughly go up by $280. So we could do it if we stretch. It's not that much, and it's really, really enticing to go to a 12-year. So I guess my question is, what do I need to ask before I commit to this?
You called here, Joe. That's the first question you should ask. The second one is, are there a lot of extra fees on this? Has the bank or credit union said to you, hey, it's going to cost you $4,000 or something to redo this new mortgage?
Oh, they said no closing fees at all. There's no closing fees.
And check with, try to nail them down on that and say, not only are there no closing fees, are there any other fees that I'm going to pay on top of this? And if it's a few hundred dollars or something, that's not a big deal in my mind. Here's one other question that I would ask is, if we were to refinance right now, what would the rate be on the same 30-year mortgage that we have right now? Because what you might find, if it's down in about the 3.5% range, which I'm guessing it might be if they're offering 2.99 on a 12, you might be better off taking the 30-year out and then making $280 more in payments per month. And what you'll find is that you'll actually probably still pay the thing off in maybe 13 years or something like that. But you'll always have the flexibility to stop making those extra payments. Whereas if you're in a 12-year fixed, you've just said your minimum payment is going to be $280 higher. And while you might be able to afford that today, that might not always be the case. And it might be the case be that you don't want to pay it off because interest rates might go up. You might have other needs for the money. You might decide that you really love having that low interest rate, potentially tax deductible interest mortgage out. And so you don't want to pay that off any faster than you have to. So I would first ask about other options within the 30-year. But yes, 2.99% on a 12-year is a great rate. And with the $280, if you think you can swing the extra payment and you don't see any other big cash needs out there for the next 12 years, that sounds like a really good deal. And again, especially if the cost to do this refinancing is minimal.
All right,
Joe,
thanks
for the call, Joe. Appreciate it. In case you just joined us, you're listening to On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is our financial planner, and he's the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We invite your phone calls and emails. The number is 800-642-1234. Email address, On Your Money, all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Okay, Kevin, tax time just a couple of months away, and you have a few ways that listeners could still save on what they pay to Uncle Sam.
Yeah, normally it's what you do during the calendar or the tax year that really affects your taxes, but it is still possible to reduce what you owe by taking things that happened last year and accounting for them on your 1040 or your state return, or doing something right now. And typically the best way to reduce your taxes is through deductions, tax credits, and making certain deposits.
So let's start with deductions. What should we be looking for?
Usually you have to itemize to have any kind of deduction make sense. And the standard deduction for married couples filing jointly for 2014 is $12,400.62 for single filers. So a lot of people don't have the big enough deduction amount to use that itemization, and so they just go with the standard. But if you try to look for more deductions that you already paid for and might be able to swing in there, that may be able to reduce the taxes. And there are two publications you want to look at, and we'll put these links up at onyourmoney.com later on today. But publication 529 and then topic 500 goes through all the different deductions that one might have to try to bring into your tax return and hopefully hopefully get up and over the standard amount to make itemizing make sense. Or if you're already itemizing, you might find more deductions that you weren't aware of. And this might be interest expenses or points if you refinanced a mortgage. It might be investment advisory fees if you paid those out of pocket. It might be medical expenses that you paid out of pocket as well. A lot of times people forget about that medical expenses technically can be deductible. Just keep in mind, if you're doing anything, and especially charitable deductions, make sure you have the receipts for it, because if you do get audited, you want to have the proof that you did actually incur that expense.
Okay, so what are some of the tax credits that we might be missing?
Now, these are usually more for lower and middle income people, and generally if you make between $30,000 to $50,000 per year, that's where these tax credits really come into play and make a big difference. One is the Earned Income Tax Credit, and this was put in place to help working people offset payroll taxes like Social Security and Medicare, and you have to be between 25 and 65, but a lot of people miss that one, so definitely look for the Earned Income Tax Credit. If you're paying for any higher education expenses, you may qualify for the American Opportunity Tax Credit or the Lifetime Learning Credit, and if you have kids under 13, or a spouse or some other dependent that you're paying for costs for, get the Child and Dependent Care Credit as well. And finally, we're going to start talking about this in our next segment, but there are tax credits available for people of lower income or middle income who have had to pay for health insurance and get it on the exchange.
Okay, so what about deposits?
You get the biggest bang for your buck with retirement accounts, because you're putting money into an account. It's your money. They can't take it away from you, but you get an immediate reduction on your tax break. And for instance, if you put $5,000 into an IRA, most people will have a reduction of about $1,000 in their income tax bill for that deposit. So it's a great way. You know, people are always looking for ways, how can I earn a little more money on my money? Well, if you're eligible to make an IRA contribution and you're not, or if you can make a spousal IRA contribution, even if your spouse is a stay-at-home person, doesn't have full-time income, they may be eligible to make an IRA contribution for themselves and still get the tax deduction on that. And self-employed people can still set up a SEP plan or a simple plan, usually by April 15th, and that also can allow them to take an even bigger tax deduction on a bigger contribution than a typical IRA will. Health savings accounts, if you're in a high deductible plan, you can still make a deposit to an HSA account. And again, if you do that before April 15th, the amount that you put into that is reduced from your taxable income, and it's still your money that you get to use to pay for the deductible portion or other high, health expenses. And then finally, we mentioned this a few weeks ago, but people who are looking to save for college for a child or a grandchild now have until April 15th to fund an EdVest College Savings Account, EDVEST, and still get a deduction on their state income taxes. It's not a lot, but for, say, a $3,000 deposit, you might see a reduction of about $100 to $200 on your state income tax bill.
Okay. Well, tax time. Get those receipts out, ladies and gentlemen, and get ready to have some fun with getting your taxes figured out. We're going to be talking more about that in just a moment. I want to give the phone number again in case you'd like to call and ask a question. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@WPR.org. We'll be back with Kevin McKinley and more of On Your Money in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we're going to continue our discussion of taxes on your money today with some news and notes on helping you get them filed. Kevin, what do we know?
Well, let's start with TurboTax, John, and that is the most popular electronic method people use to file their taxes. 29 million people used them last year versus 7 million each for the next closest competitors, H&R Block and Tax Act. And there was a controversy because TurboTax, which is a nice product, but what they did is they people either bought the discs or downloaded it and went online to use it. And then right at the last minute, they said, oh, if you're going to file these certain types of schedules, like itemizing deductions or whatever, you need to actually upgrade from the one you're used to using and pay us $20 or $30 or $40 or $50 more than the current one. And people felt really railroaded by that because they got all, they bought it, the original one they had always used. They didn't receive any notice that they were going to have to pay an extra fee to file their taxes in the same manner that they had in the past for it. And of course, they went through all the work of entering the data only to find out that they were going to have to pay more to do that. And it wasn't a significant cost, but people felt like it wasn't fair. And so Intuit, the company that makes TurboTax, said, all right, we're going to give you a $25 rebate. People said, that's not enough. And then they finally said, all right, you get free upgrades for it. But keep an eye on that, especially if you have an older version. Make sure you know that you shouldn't have to pay extra for that, those other filings for it. And then there was another issue because several states, starting with Minnesota and other ones, found that there were some fraudulent tax returns being filed using TurboTax. And it's not that TurboTax is, it wasn't their problem or their fault, but it, people were using them as a vehicle to file these. And they said, well, we're getting a bunch of ones we've already found to be fraudulent. We're going to shut this down until we can talk to TurboTax and clear it up. And TurboTax then said, oh, you know what, we're not going to allow any state tax filings for the time being until we figure this out. The problem has been resolved, and they are allowing state tax filings again using TurboTax. But keep an eye on that because you might run into a roadblock when you are trying to file your state tax return in the future.
Okay, so how do these programs compare to working with a real person?
They're much less expensive usually, although a lot of times people come to me and say, you know what, I'm using this tax person. I think I'm just going to do it myself or use a software program. And I say, well, how much are you paying? And they say, well, it was $125 last year. Well, to be able to get a real live person to talk to for $125, I think is a good deal. If you use a CPA and you have a more complex situation, generally you can expect to pay somewhere between $500 and $1,000 and more if you have a small business or you have a lot of rental real estate. But some people who never considered using a tax preparer, especially CPA, may want to do it because CPAs have become almost as a default the new experts on the healthcare laws and healthcare tax credits for purchasing your own insurance under ACA. So this might be a good year if you are under that or you think you will be in the near future to go to a CPA and say, can you help me navigate both the issues and the responsibilities and the opportunities that I have in terms of getting the insurance but getting a subsidy to pay that off? Go to WICPA.org to look for a CPA in Wisconsin. That's WICPA.org. Or go to PTIN Directory.com, PTIN as in Nancy, directory.com, and you can search by people who have filed to become tax preparers. Not all of them are CPAs, but by location. A lot of time this is nicer for people who live in a rural area, want someone close by. PTIN directory.com, and again, we'll have those links up at onyourmoney.com hopefully later on today.
Okay, so where else can we go for help?
The IRS is swamped right now because of the health care issues. Also, they've had a lot of their funding cut back, so it's difficult for them to get the people up to help people in need right now. You can still get the free file program if you have under $60,000 in income. You can file your taxes electronically for free, and generally there's a small charge for some of the other types of things you might need. Like a state tax return might cost $10 or $20, or if you want to, if you do need to itemize, you might have to pay a little extra for that. The VITA TCE form, VITA is the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, and TCE is Tax Counseling for the Elderly, and AARP is a big sponsor of that. So you can look around at the IRS website for the VITA and TCE, search for a person in your area who you can take your information to. Hopefully they can help you. And one place that a lot of people forget, especially if they don't feel like printing off a 30-page document on their own, then go to the local library. And libraries this time of the year are very busy helping people find the tax forms they need, getting online access if they don't, and maybe even answering the questions, because sometimes they have staff and assistants right there in the library helping people out.
All right. So what other developments should we be aware of?
Well, we've been talking about fraudulent tax returns. When people take a Social Security number from someone else, try to file a tax return demanding a refund with false numbers, and the IRS and the states are all very concerned about this. And so the state of Wisconsin has implemented a program where they will actually be calling people randomly and asking them to verify who they are by a little quiz, by saying, you know, what's your address or something else, so that it matches up with the return. And they're doing this in part to make sure that they're reducing the fraud, but also to throw a little scare tactic into the people who are trying to do this. suggest that they might get caught more easily because there's going to be a random call. So if you get this call, don't panic about it. You don't necessarily have to answer the questions, but it will delay you getting your refund in if they can't verify that you are who you say you are and you've already filed your return. And if you don't do it via phone, then you have to send in the information via mail within a few weeks after getting this call.
All right. Good advice. Let's hope we all get our numbers right so we don't get that dreaded letter from the IRS telling us we had a problem. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to ask questions. We'll start in Superior, where Marianne is on the phone. Marianne, you're on with Kevin McKinley.
Good morning. I was just going to give a little information in regards to the freezing of your credit report. I've had mine frozen for about 12 years. I had an incident where I received a couple of mailings, in fact, from the state of Wisconsin with my Social Security number on the outside of the envelope. So I followed the advice, and I froze those reports. I have not opened them in 12 years. And I was thinking about purchasing something one time, and I found out that even if you unfreeze, you can do that with maybe just one agency. You can ask if you're going to get a loan from somebody, who do you check with, and then you can unfreeze with that one agency. You don't have to unfreeze with all three agencies.
That's a great point, Marianne. You're exactly right. And if you are freezing your credit report, which I suggest you look into it, and in the future, if you are applying for a loan, and sometimes, things like cell phone contracts or apartments, as long as it's a new company that you don't have any relationship with, they might say to you, we need to do a credit check for you before we can approve you. Authorize us to do that. When they ask you that question, then, like Marianne said, say, which bureau are you using and when are you going to do it? Because I'll contact them, thaw it out, open the report back up, and then freeze it once again. But that's right, Marianne. Thank you.
Marianne, thanks for the call. Let's go to Junction City, and Art is on the line. Art, you're on with Kevin McKinley.
Thank you for taking the call. The wife and I just recently retired, and we're wondering, you know, we're not eligible now to put monies into a Roth or an IRA. Was wondering what would be a way of investing extra monies. What we have now is through traditional pension and Social Security.
What's your goal for the money, Art? Is it money that you'd like to have hopefully grow down the road, or is it money that you might need for emergencies?
Probably not so much emergencies. Our income is pretty reasonable, but something that might grow for, you know, just future eventualities.
Okay. It's very tricky right now. Asset prices are generally very high across the board. It's hard to find good value compared to, say, 4 or 5 years ago. If you do say that you are comfortable absorbing some risk and with a downfall, index funds like the ones offered by Vanguard are a very good low-cost way to go. Keep in mind, though, that any money that you invest in just about any kind of thing beyond savings bonds and CDs and money markets has risk to it. And especially in these times, don't be surprised if in some year you get a 30 or 40 or 50% loss depending on the type of investment. And that's the price that you pay for trying to get this greater return by going into the stocks. And a lot of people try to say, well, I don't want that drop. I'm going to go into bonds because bonds are safer. Yeah, technically, bonds are safer than stocks, but bonds can still drop in value if interest rates rise or if the economy affects the ability of the bond issuer to pay it off. So bonds generally have lower return and lower risk, but there still is risk in there as well. So it's hard to give you an exact investment way to go, but that's a good place to start.
Can you do that directly with Fidelity, or can you go?
Yep, you can contact Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard or any of those people directly, and they will be very happy to talk with you. Sometimes they have minimums that are above what some people can invest initially, but if you have more than, say, $5,000 to $10,000 to invest, all of those people can help you and do it directly. And usually it's, you know, you don't get a lot of service, but you also don't pay a lot for it either.
Art, thanks a lot, and good luck in your retirement. Let's go to Eau Claire next, and Linda is on the phone. Linda, you're on with Kevin McKinley.
Good morning, Kevin. I just first want to say that I look forward to spending Tuesday mornings in my car so that I can listen to you talk about
thank you, Wenda.
Your knowledge. Anyway, I bought a duplex about 12 years ago, lived in half, rented out the other half, and paid aggressively on my 30-year mortgage to try and get it paid down early. And then a couple of years ago, I bought another house as a business venture, and I presently live in that, so I'm renting the duplex out. Have recently thought about selling the duplex, but the capital gains is not something I want to sacrifice. So what would your opinion be for me to do with the payment to my duplex? I'm still paying about $300 more a month on my mortgage there.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to paying just what the bottom line is that they need and stick that money into my present house.
Okay, so you would keep the duplex, not sell it? That's what you're saying?
Yeah, and I'm the capital gains tax, I would sacrifice selling it. I'm just not comfortable with that.
Okay. A couple things on that. One is generally capital gains taxes are my favorite kinds of taxes to pay because it means you made money on something. And
right.
The rates on them are lower than income, so it's better to make money from capital gains generally than it is from income. Have you looked at 1035 property exchanges?
No.
Okay. If you have an accountant, or you can go online and look for it, but 1035 property exchanges allow you to sell one property and move the proceeds into another one and avoid the capital gains, at least for the time being. Now, then it rolls over and continues on. You don't get out of it completely, but if you just say, I don't feel like paying it right now, it's a good way to do that. But now then you have to have some other kind of qualifying investment property that you're willing to own, and usually it's not a good idea to buy another property just to do the 1035 qualified exchange. I think that's a good idea to keep the cash on hand and make the minimum payment. It might make the owning the duplex more palatable if your actual cost can go down by the amount that you're paying into it. What's your interest rate on the current mortgage on that duplex, Linda?
It's at 5.6.
Okay. Have you looked into refinancing it at all?
I have, but it wasn't... because it's income property, it wasn't mm-hmm. as low as your
traditional mortgage.
Right.
How long ago? Did you look into it?
About 2 years ago.
Okay, I'd maybe take another swing at that and just see, hey, you know, this is a new world. Lenders and the world change all the time, and just because a lender says one thing today, it doesn't mean it's going to be true tomorrow. And it's not because they're trying to fool us, it's just because their parameters of doing business change. And so I would check back with the lenders and see if you can refinance it. And if you can't, then you might say, you know what, this has been a good run. I'm going to sell it. And if you say, no, I don't want to sell it, then yes, not paying down the mortgage any faster than you have to and putting into a house that gives you more enjoyment because you're living there, I think is a good idea.
Okay. So do you think the property exchange is that money able to put into the house that I presently live in without
probably not. You typically, unless it were a non-residential, non-primary resident, usually can't put it back into your own house again. But no, look it up online, and if you have a tax person, ask them what they might think about it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, and good luck. All right, Kevin, what's our website of the week?
John, we've been talking a lot about taxes and trying to feel better about finances, so it seems appropriate to go to a website set up by the good people in the American CPA firm and association. It's called 360financialliteracy.org, 360financialliteracy.org. Lots of free information there on where you can find out about finances and taxes as well. And we'll put that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, again, hopefully later on today.
All right, Kevin, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
All right, Kevin McKinley, thank you very much. Kevin McKinley is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You hear him every week here on Your Money on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Have a great day. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.